You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is another edition of the Russian Orthodox Nationalist here on Radio Albion. Today's date is, well, it's very late, May 3rd, 2025, and as some of you may have heard, for a couple of days I lost power out here, strangely, since there was no storm near me. There was a storm in Pittsburgh, but we're quite far from Pittsburgh. I have no idea why the power went out. It didn't make much sense, and still doesn't make much sense. So I missed a few of the Solzhenitsyn recordings, as well as my Daily Nationalist, but we are back online, thank God, again, at least for now. So, many of you, almost all of you, if you follow me at all, have heard me refer to Lord Byron, Johann Byron in particular. Now, while he is not, he is more of a symbolic figure for the collapse of old Russia in the 18th century. This is a key issue for me, partially because, at least given the strictures and the institutions at the time, it was just as hard on Russia and the church as it was under Lenin. Of course, Lenin had far more trauma and institutions and better technology and bureaucracies to work with. That was not the case in this era. And the paper I'm delivering tonight is called Killing the King, The Fate of Orthodox Russia Under Anna Ivanovna and the Imperonoshchina, or the rule, the situation, negative situation, symbolized by Lord Johann Byron. Now, a lot has been written about the chaos of the 18th century in Russia, and for many years, we're talking about that specific period between the death of Peter the Great and the coup of Catherine II. So from 1725 to 1762, roughly. Now, I've noticed that court historians are trying to paper over the Imperonoshchina. Lord Byron was a Philo-Semite, he was a Freemason, and he loathed everything Russian. So needless to say, your court historians are going to try to rehabilitate his reputation. But in that era, or at least for a few years in that era, he ruled Russia absolutely, engaging in mass murder. But then there are plenty of people in academia now in mass murder denial, just it's acceptable in his case. They've tried to rescue Byron, again, due to his violently anti-Russian prejudice, and at least partly because of his Philo-Semitism and Freemasonry. Now, the era is not so much about Lord Byron personally. Imperonoshchina, you know, his name is in it. But it has more to do with the aftermath of the revolution of Peter the Great that was imposed on Russia. So Peter's attempt to destroy the traditional Orthodox foundation of the monarchy and state led to tremendous trauma and confusion. So under these kind of circumstances, foreign mercenaries, I mean mostly politicians, poured into the country and treated Russia like a personal fief. Now this era, 1725 to 1762, the mockery of so-called Catherine the First, I have more claim to be an empress of Russia than she did, from 1725, 1727, and what I call the two Annas, Anna of Courland and Anna Leopoldovna, who died in 1746. Somewhat similar, more to the 1990s in Russia than 1920s. Foreigners using these rulers, in quotes, as cover, ruled in secret and essentially raped the country. I like talking about it for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is it's a classic example of what an oligarchy truly is and how it's established, how it comes about, not in theory, but in actual practice. Oligarchies, by their very nature, are secretive, they're deceptive, they're usually materialist and egocentric, they're fractious, and certainly cosmopolitan. Their sworn enemy is a centralized national monarchy with strong religious nationalists in charge who have the power to overrule the plutocracy, or the rule of the wealthy. The symbol of the killing of the king, an ancient concept, the Masons use it quite a bit, talking about the father, the monarch, Peter the Great and the false bishop Theophan Prokopovich were the killers of the king, or the father. Once the father is killed, the oligarchs, or the sons, have to now negotiate in building a state under their rule. However, they still need the father's reputation. They still need him, or at least his memory, to legitimize them. So, of course, they need to use deception to make it seem like the crown was still functioning, that the father is still there, at least symbolically. Now, the use of women, I mean, Catherine I was besotted and probably insane from alcohol poisoning, as well as the two Annas, fairly weak women, it made this much easier. And as I've said before, it took the entirety of the 19th century to rebuild the institutions of Russian royalism. And, of course, the war kind of eliminated a lot of that. Anna of Courland, the daughter of Tsar Ivan V and Tsarina Pereskeva Fedorovna, born in 1693. She is born in Moscow. She grew up in the Kremlin. Her sisters were Catherine and Pereskeva. She received her education at home. She studied German, French, ethics, dancing, which back then was kind of a big deal. She eventually moved to St. Petersburg in 1708. However, when she was 17, she married the Duke of Courland. We're talking about today what would be Latvia. The Duke of this state was Frederick Wilhelm. October 31st, 1710. It was done under the Orthodox Rite. Her husband, this Frederick, died 3 months later. Actually, on his way to Courland at the assistance of Peter the Great, meaning that Anna lived 20 years as a dowager duchess in Latvia, Jelgava. In Courland, Anna was said to have led a modest lifestyle, but it also meant that she needed assistance from the wealthy in Russia, turning to Peter and then to quote-unquote Empress Catherine. I've mentioned Courland many times, and it comes up again in this period of Russian history quite a bit. It's a duchy, Courland and Semigalia. It was sort of independent, existing from 1561 to 1795, the partition of Poland. Had about 650,000 people in 1750. Technically, it was under the Poles, but it was an autonomous entity. The era that we're talking about, Russia acquired great influence because, you know, Anna of Courland served as a regent there from 1711 until 1730. The last of the ducal line, when she had married, died in 1737. She arranged for it to be given over to Ernst Johann von Biron. Life there erased her Russian features. Even Russians thought of her as a German. She had very rough, kind of hard kind of habits. She largely forgotten her Russian origin. The Baltic Germans, what we call the Balts today, were promoted to every position. She was a very passionate woman in a bad sense, or revenge, pride. She was extremely cruel. She was morbid. She enjoyed mocking people. She didn't have much by way of principles, making her the perfect front woman. Now, the oligarchy, or at least the upper reaches of the oligarchy, were found institutionalized in the Supreme Privy Council, which, of course, is a foreign concept to begin with. It consisted of 8 people. 5 seats belonged to the Dolgorukov family and the Golitsyns. They were the ones who invited Anna, Peter's niece, by the way, invited her to Russia. They saw her as easy to manipulate, and by herself, they were absolutely right. When she arrived in Petersburg and Moscow from Jelgava, remember, at the time, you really had 2 capitals. But what was important is that she needed the assistance of wealthy people. She developed a charming personality. It's also important that she had no faction in Russia. There was no group in Russia that supported her. Again, easy to manipulate. But the Privy Council at the time had Menshikov, Count Apraksin, Golovkin, Golitsyn, and Baron Osterman. These were the Masonic core of the oligarchy, the highest level of the oligarchy. They're like any oligarch, any body of oligarchs. They wanted to limit the central power, and they first approached Catherine I, who didn't know where she was half the time. I've said before that Peter appointed her illegitimately as empress to mock the throne, and they wanted to create a situation where the Privy Council dominated the monarchy. No decrees, no laws, everything had to go through them. Also, the Senate, which, again, is a new institution created by Peter, loses its power because it was appointed by the crown. The only thing that matters is this oligarchic Privy Council. So, foreign affairs, military, naval, ministries, not under the Senate anymore, but again, under the council. And the same thing goes for the church, and this is a huge problem. This means that even before Anna took over, and we're talking about the famous conditions here, they were trying to run an oligarchic state. What are the conditions? This was the first step in creating as much of a pure oligarchy as they possibly could. In most places, pure oligarchy doesn't work. They need to hide behind something. Rich people can't come out there and say, we rule because we're rich and we hate you. They can't talk like that. Sometimes they do. They need a cover, whether it be the so-called, constitution or the old republic like in Florence, a monarchy in various places. And it's great to have a monarchy with no power because they could blame for everything. A group of oligarchs, Dmitry Golitsyn, Gavril Golovkin, a few others, wrote up a set of conditions for Anna. We'll let you take the throne so long as you agree to this. And if you agree, we will put you on the throne. Now, in most places, this is seen as a progressive measure. This is empowering freedom or something stupid like that. No, it's only to empower the oligarchs who have been under the thumb of a strong monarchy for a very long time. And they were sick of it. The war is constant. No different than their own souls. The passionate ego side and the common good side, the virtuous side. And this was drawn up in 1730 after the death of Peter II. Wonderful kid, but he was so brief it doesn't really matter. And here's a text. Since by the will of Almighty God and the general desire of the Russian people, we, upon the death of the most serene, most powerful, great sovereign Peter II, Emperor and autocrat of all Russia, our most beloved sovereign nephew, have assumed the imperial all Russian throne, and following the divine law, I, meaning Anna, intend to wish to conduct my government in such a way that it may serve, first of all, for the glorification of the divine name, and for the well-being of our entire state and our subjects. For this reason, we hereby most firmly promise my most important care and effort will be not only for the maintenance, but for the utmost dissemination of our Orthodox faith, of the Greek confession, also by accepting the crown, not to enter into marriage for the rest of my life, not to appoint an heir. We promise that since the integrity and well-being of every state consists in good advice, for this reason we will always maintain a supreme privy council of 8 men already established. Without this supreme privy council, there will be agreement. What are the conditions? Now, you go back even to the Magna Carta, right? This is how oligarchs function. This is the power that they want. It sounds good at first blush, but of course, it's their own ego. Condition 1, no war could be entered into without their consent. Number 2, of course, the same for peace and treaties. Number 3, without the Privy Council, the Crown could levy no taxes. Number 4, no one should be granted any rank, land, or anything above the rank of colonel. No one could be assigned to noble affairs at any level. Guards and other regiments shall be under the jurisdiction of the Supreme Privy Council. Number 5, the nobility's life, property, and honor shall not be taken away without trial. 6, no grant of any estate or village should be done from the crown. 7, neither Russians nor foreigners shall be appointed to court ranks without the advice of the same council. Number 8, I will not spend state revenues and maintain all loyal subjects in our constant mercy, meaning her own. If I do not fulfill or keep anything according to this promise, I will be deprived of the Russian crown. Now, this is where I'm convinced that academics have no idea. When they read something like this, it sounds great, so they think it's great. Life, property, honor. They think, oh, this is the beginning of a constitution. No, trial of your peers mean only other oligarchs can judge oligarchs. The crown will have nothing to say. No one else will have anything to say. Granting an income, granting an estate. You can't appoint anyone to any court rank. In other words, you can't build up your own royal faction. Taxation, of course, a big deal with them. And, like number 4 says, there is no military appointment at any level without their consent. So it sounds great to your typical liberal academic, but these are specifically drawn up. You see this everywhere. You know, the French Revolution, English Revolution, any place a monarchy is overthrown and replaced by very powerful, wealthy people, which it always is, these are the sort of things in different languages that they demand. Now, it was unpublished for a long time. They wanted to keep it secret, not for, you know, the general population, but also the lower levels of the nobility, the middle levels, who weren't necessarily oligarchs. But when it was read out in 1730, there was a split that emerged, which they were trying to avoid. Now, the conditions, you have this whole nonsense political theory, Republican theory of about the conditions in the academic literature. But they don't know how to read something like this and how to tear it apart. Now, every oligarch had his own specific program. Remember, they're right next to Poland, who had an elective monarchy, which meant that the oligarchs ran everything. But you had all these different proposals. This isn't political thought. This is self-interest. Some like the English version of the crown, the Polish version, which they liked, and plenty wanted a so-called aristocratic republic, abolishing the crown altogether. Sometimes people don't realize the difference between an oligarch and an aristocrat. As Aristotle said very clearly, it has to do with the common good on the one hand and their own good on the other. An oligarch looks out for himself. An aristocrat looks out for the whole, for the nation, for the state. So you can't just say oligarchy is the rule of the few, because if they are true aristocrats, then it's not an oligarchy. Aristocrats tend to become oligarchs without a countervailing power that is the crown or a military government or something like that. There was another project called the Cherkasy Tatyushev Project. They wanted a oligarchic supreme government of 21 men, the introduction of quote-unquote elections for its members, senators, governors, presidents, and you know, you could see how academics are waxing poetic about all of this. But this does nothing more than empower the wealthy. And elections are a joke when they control everything. And these would be elected from a second chamber of 100 men. And they wanted the Supreme Privy Council abolished because it really was just a handful of your highest ranking oligarchs, the wealthiest and most powerful men in Russia, many of whom directly hated it, many of whom were Masons. Dmitry Golitsyn was one of the major figures here. There was some debate whether or not this Privy Council was going to be, or Supreme Council was going to be permanent. Now, there was another faction, equally wretched, and it's from the false bishop Theophan Prokopovich. We'll get to him in a minute. He ran the Russian church under Peter. He was not Orthodox. He, as a matter of fact, disliked and despised Orthodoxy. I don't know how you can talk about canonical regularity with this man in charge. I've spoken about him before. Not only was he an absolute tyrant, but he was a Masonic. Sometimes he sounded like a materialist, but he basically was a Protestant. When Anna showed up in Russia, your lower nobles, middle nobles, really probably the more popular, they probably represented the general opinion, said, tear these conditions up. Now, Milukov, some others write that this is something like the state system of Sweden. After the reconstruction of 1720, the reforms of Charles XI in 1680 were put aside, the so-called time of freedom. Nonsense. The lower and middle nobility, the people who did the work, these were, you know, more populist, did not support the establishing of any of these schemes. Nobles under both Peter and his successors knew what kind of men these were. Limiting the Tsar's power, the Tsarina's power, would be a situation where you don't have one autocratic sovereign, you would have eight or nine. It's the very definition of an oligarchy. So Anna received news about this and agreed to it. Of her own free will, essentially abolishing the autocracy. Supreme Privy Council, the oligarchy, would rule Russia entirely. Now, the ordinary nobility, and most of these nobles were no wealthier than the peasants on their estates. Most of them wanted a strong monarch. There needed to be a power strong enough to overrule the plutocrats. Plutocracy is more specifically the rule of the wealthy, a subtype of oligarch, but you know, they're in practice they're the same. So Anna stated that she said, before my accession to the Russian throne, according to sound judgment, we devised the necessary methods for conducting that government, and having signed it with our own hand, sent it to the Supreme Privy Council. Now, as I wrote in my first book, the oligarchs kept a lot of people from talking to Anna. They knew what would be said. Prokopovich, who wanted a tyranny, not an oligarchy, was one of the few, because he was a confessor, was able to get to Anna and essentially talked her out of it. Golitsyn said, my God, Anna's going to sign this. Oh, God, truly shines upon Russia. All of this was, you know, they talk about orthodoxy and Christian faith. These are just, again, your typical deception that these people promote. Talking about how we're going to seek only the common good and well-being of the state. Prince Cherkasy stepped forward and wanted more and more discussion, because the more discussion there was, the more schemes and the more divisions you would have. They also would be able to monitor different layers of the elite. As always, one of the first things that the Privy Council did at this point when they thought that Anna was going to sign these was they already were going to round up the disobedient, a prison or death. They started with the Prosecutor General, Pavel Yagushinsky. But they had unleashed quite a bit of chaos in these meetings. Supreme Privy Council wasn't just the highest level of the oligarchs. They made themselves unpopular amongst the elite. All of these discussions and meetings and schemes, and the very fact that they weren't allowing anyone to talk to Anna except Theophan, got people very suspicious. These debates were just a matter of degree. How many oligarchs should be included? Should it just be a handful? Should it be a lot of them? They were hoping for chaos, splits in this oligarchic movement, so that they, being cohesive, can maintain power. Now, when Anna agreed to these conditions, it was done in private. It was not done in public. February 15, 1730, she solemnly entered Moscow. On the basis of these conditions, which they still thought she was going to sign, and said she was going to, the dignitaries of the state took the oath to her, but that would soon change because she immediately tore them up, physically. Now, she didn't do this on her own. It was under the advice of false bishop Theophan Prokopovich. And, of course, that would promote him, just like he was under Peter, her main advisor. Anna was crowned in Moscow on April 28, 1730. She was not an independent woman, just a different faction of the oligarchy was going to rule. She was going to rule as a so-called autocrat, but under the guidance of a handful of oligarchs, including Prokopovich. Prokopovich, of course, despised orthodoxy, and he said so. He led the empress to receive communion right into the altar, which was huge. It was a scandal at the time, and it should have been. And he got technical about it and said, well, you know, monarch can receive communion within the altar. Well, she is not your typical monarch. Theophan wrote much of the law under Peter the Great. He was the intellectual side of the Petrine Revolution. You had others like Ostermann, Count Reinhold Lowenwald, liked the idea of an oligarchy using someone like Anna, pretending that she's an autocrat. So they wanted an oligarchy, just not the Supreme Privy Council. So it was a mock autocracy, and this is eventually what happened. Ostermann was working for Frederick the Great in Prussia, used the personal interests of Prokopovich and Yagushinsky to establish Prussian power in Russia. So ultimately, the so-called conditions, the explicitly oligarchic rule lasted really only a few days. And it was very popular when she ripped up the conditions. She didn't trust the oligarchs, the council, or even the lower gentry. She didn't even trust them. She didn't even know them. The only people who she thought she could trust were Germans and Balts that she brought from Courland in Latvia. So regardless of whether Anna formalized the autocracy or the oligarchy, I should say the mock autocracy or the oligarchy, these Masonic newcomers were going to rule Russia regardless. Now, we're talking about the Ronovshchina, the rule of not so much Byron as a man, but the concept of this foreign oligarchy. Byron, actually his real name was Ernest von Buren in Latvia, Semigalia. In 1690, he died in 1772. He was educated in Königsberg, but because of his awful conduct, he was expelled. He was an extremely unpopular man, off-putting wherever he went. He only cared about money. In 1714, he tried to make his fortune in Russia by some scam. trying to use Princess Charlotte, or Sophia, the so-called wife of the Tsarevich Alexei. But he was unsuccessful. He returned to Courland, but one of his sisters was a lady-in-waiting to Anna, the Anna that we're talking about here. One of the ministers, Peter Bestushev, took a, took a shine to Byron's sister. So through his sister's intercession and the minister's favor, Byron gained a place at Anna's court. Byron was allegedly attractive. He was very manipulative. The women would call him a narcissist today, probably correctly. And even when Bestushev got in the way, he disgraced and banished him. But at this point, his influence over Anna, usually clashing with Prokopovich, was paramount. And this would be the zenith of his power. Byron also married a lady-in-waiting to the regent Anna, Benigia von Triden. Was allegedly arranged by Anna, which was a way to cover over her own relationship with Byron. Actually worked out. His wife was devoted to him. She probably knew, but it was too lucrative. So when Anna ripped up the conditions, Byron and his wife moved to Moscow. Now you notice right away, typical of an oligarch, he doesn't get his positions through hard work or initiative or intellect. He gets it through manipulation. Someone knows somebody and he calls in a favor. So Byron became Grand Chamberlain. Again, these are all new offices from the Petrian era. He was a count. Again, words like count didn't exist until this era. He was granted a large estate with a guaranteed income, 50,000 crowns a year, actually. And only then did he start signing his name Byron, B-I-R-O-N, rather than Bilin or Bruin. He used many versions of his last name. He even tried to adopt the arms of a French ducal house, Byron, a totally unconnected family, trying to insinuate that he was connected to them. It was all deceit. He was in the perfect place at the perfect time for this kind of Machiavellianism. So in other words, he was the son of a court servant. He adopted a new name. He passed himself off as a representative of some ancient aristocratic family. He was favored by Anna through his connections and made himself, he was a flatterer, like Prokopovich, made himself indispensable. Of course, he hated the royal circle. He was purely an opportunist. He was a con man. This was a mockery of the Russian people, something brought about by the Petrine Revolution. Byron became de facto ruler of Russia 5 years after the death of Peter I. But it was Peter and his revolution that brought Russian politics to this level. Russia was heading to the abyss. The famous historian Sergei Platonov talks about the 10 years that Anna, quote-unquote, ruled. He says, the reign of Anna, he's talking about both Annas here. And he's right. It doesn't really matter if he's talking about Courland and Leopoldovna. Sad era in Russian life in the 18th century. Aliens were ruling Russia. Under Anna, the first place in the court was occupied by Germans. The head of the current administration stood a German Osterman. In the colleges and ministries, Germans. The head of the army stood Germans, Minich and Lasso. Of these, the main force belonged to Byron. He was a completely insignificant and immoral man by nature. Being Anna's favorite and enjoying her trust, Byron interfered in all manners of government. He had no views, no program of activity, not the slightest acquaintance with the Russian way of life or people. It did not prevent him from despising Russians and consciously persecuting everything Russian. When the murmur arose, Byron, in order to preserve his own safety, resorted to a system of denunciations, which developed to a terrifying degree. The secret chancery was founded under the Preobrazhensky Order of Peter the Great, inundated with political denunciations and cases. No one could consider themselves safe from the words and deeds, an exclamation that usually began the procedure of denunciation and investigation. Petty everyday feuds, a sense of revenge, base greed, could lead to any person to investigation, prison, and torture. Terror hung over society. Now, the secret chancery functioned very much like the Cheka later on. The use of denunciations, informants. This is the method of the Petrine Revolution. So who financed Byron? A Jewish banker named Lippmann. He became the court banker, openly sold positions, places, royal favors, engaged in usury. He was a loan shark. Byron's wife spent money to an almost manic degree, none of it hers. She stole $2 million worth of diamonds at prices at the time for her own use. Her dresses were valued at 400,000 rubles. It was roughly one-to-one with the value at the time, value now. When Byron became regent, she ordered one dress sewn with pearls, 100,000 rubles. Again, money was not hers, but it was the era of interrogations, irons, torture. Peter the Great wiped out the hierarchy of the Orthodox Church. Everyone had been replaced. Many of them had been killed. Some of them had been tortured. Many of them were in prison. Others were exiled. Oligarchy doesn't know any law, so there's no due process. Man was accused of something, he was never heard from again. Anyone who mattered, even remotely, in either Moscow or Petersburg, was terrified. After the reign of both Annas came to an end, as a Russian scholar named Ristolovich said, it was as if a resurrection from the dead had occurred. Hundreds, thousands of people who had disappeared without a trace and were considered dead came to life again. From all the remote places of Siberia after the death of the Empress Anna, liberated sufferers flocked to their homeland or to the places of their former service, some with torn out nostrils, some with cut tongues, some with legs worn out from chains, some with hands mutilated from torture and broken backs. I should note many of these were bishops. This is the legacy of Peter the Great. This brilliant reformer nonsense, this false legend, including Orthodox people, turning a blind eye to this catastrophe. Now, Anna was the widow of the Duke of Courland, who was a Lutheran. She was a Lutheran. So-called Archbishop Theophon changed the words Orthodox faith to Christian faith in his sermons. Again, Prokopovich, while running the Orthodox Church, was not an Orthodox man. Anna demanded that the church hold annual prayers for her God-pleasing rule. She was very confused between the two. Prokopovich very much loved the Lutheran Church. And anyone who complained about this, the secret chantry persecuted them. Clergymen by the hundreds and thousands were denounced and removed. All clergy were obliged to swear in writing their loyalty to the empress. I'm saying that there's a new martyr. This is no different than any new martyrs of the Soviet era. There's an army of new martyrs. We'll talk about them in just a minute. Anna was not an Orthodox ruler at any level whatsoever, neither with Peter, neither with Catherine. None of them were, with the exception of Elizabeth. The maintenance of her own court cost 500% more than prior to Peter, despite zero inflation. Splendor, extravagance. You know, she claimed that she was a huntress. So she'd go out hunting, and all that would happen is they'd take an animal, and they grab it, and they let it go and have her shoot it as if she's, you know, tracking it. That's typical of the mentality of the time. She loved the jesters, especially if they got raunchy. And the more this occurred, the more the court and the country descended into this Masonic bacchanal, the more she liked it. this was a period of German occupation and Masonic occupation. The rule of Byron, it's not so much its ethnic composition, but the hatred of all things Russian. The Masonic order loathed the Russians for the same reason Karl Marx did, for the same reason that postmodern capitalists do. It's the bulwark against revolution and all of these revolutionary movements. German occultists who ruled Russia and these so-called monarchs who carried this stuff out saw it nothing less than the destruction of the Russian nobility and the church. Anna didn't reign at all. And anything that was is said of her, things happened under her rule, had nothing to do with her personally. It was nominal. She created two new guards regiments. A military reform was launched to ensure no patriotic rebellion could find a foundation. Again, the manifesto and the national oath to her and her heir. Creating a cabinet of ministers, which was specifically designed to institutionalize this foreign oligarchy and its rule over the country. Because of these foreigners, you had this growth of industry connected with Prussia, especially Germany, and the Baltics. Total volume of trade increased, but it only benefited this tiny group who profited from it. The secret investigative affairs chancery headed by Andrei Ushakov, 1731, that was restored and strengthened. Again, we've already discussed that. Torture was used widely during any investigation. In this brief era, you're talking about maybe 10,000 people, many bishops and priests who were by name, we know by name, there were many others, tortured and exiled. People will say that schools were organized, but these were hotbeds of secular thought. The point, and Prokopovich did this, so-called head of the church, former union, to eradicate Orthodox thinking from students. Yeah, Anna may have paid, you know, lip service to the church for political purposes, but it was very clear, and all contemporaries say this, that she despised the Russian clergy. Probably not as much as Prokopovich despised them. And just like Peter, bishops were removed from their positions all the time. And it was purged over and over and over again. The so-called Holy Synod only had four people on it in 1730, but it was increased to 12. But so many bishops were repressed, by 1740, there was only one bishop and one archpriest that remained. Just 1732 to 1733, just in that period, the secret chancery, 148 clergymen were sentenced to various types of punishment, either torture or death, amounting to what it comes down to 37.5% of the total number of those convicted. Who organized these? Archbishop Theophan of Novgorod, Theophan Prokopovich. He wanted to use Anna to destroy the Orthodox Church and to throw Orthodox dissenters into prison. Now, these people are talking about, you know, Patriarch Sergius and ecumenism. They refuse to talk about this era. They make a big deal about the calendar. Yeah, I agree with them. But Peter changed the calendar completely. He demanded that years be figured from the birth of Christ, not from the creation of the world. This is why all believers use the creation of the world figure. Prokopovich said orthodoxy is superstition. Archbishop Theophan, in his spiritual regulations, attacked the Orthodox liturgies. And yet, during the Sunday of Orthodoxy, the Russian Church says this. This is what they chant. To the most right-believing sovereign emperors, Peter I, Peter II, Peter III, Paul I, Alexander, Nicholas, Alexander II, and III, and to the most pious sovereign empresses, Catherine I, Anna, Elizabeth Petrovna, Catherine II, Elizabeth, Alexandra Fedorovna, and Maria Alexandrovna, memory eternal. So people can go on, they want about the Soviet clergy and everything else. They have to deal with this too. There was no canonical regularity. That was interrupted. Clearly, over and over again, not just once. Wonderful Orthodox people, my friends, will chant this on the Sunday of Orthodoxy, knowing that most of the people listed here were either Masonic or openly persecuted the church or hated Orthodoxy. having Catherine the First in here, having Peter the Great in here is bad enough. The Annas. Peter and his successors were open persecutors of the Orthodox Church en masse. Peter himself was a Mason, and Alexander the First, at least as far as the official history goes, promoted Masonry in Russia through his Bible Society. October 18, 1731, the final, crushing humiliation of the Church took place, the subordination of the Synod to the Senate. Dependence of what, the Synod only was a handful of people anyway, to the Lutheran and anti-Orthodox Masonic Ostermann. 1738, only one person, one bishop was at the Synod. Sometimes it was bypassed entirely. But nothing could be done without Masonic approval. There was no canons or anything else. There was no enthronement of bishops. They were moved from place to place. Because Archbishop Theophan remained the chief confessor in Russia under Anna, everything published at the time was under his censorship. He called himself the most learned man of his day, and he probably was, but that was only to serve materialism and Protestant arrogance. Well, a bishop's supposed to be a monk, right? Well, he was an extremely wealthy man. He had massive land holdings that he held personally. 16,000 peasants. Two mansions in Petersburg. A mansion in Moscow. Another one in Vladikino, near Moscow. He had a vacation house in Peterhof and Arendenbaum. Massive material fees from his estate. Surrounded himself with the most luxurious furnishings. At the same time, due to denunciations of this fraud, many bishops in Russia were arrested, tortured, deprived of their rank, and exiled, at best, to Siberian monasteries. Same thing goes for the parish clergy. They even forced the clergy to plow their own land to separate the clergymen from the parish. The landlords were encouraged, and they did, fearlessly, with impunity, manipulated and humiliated the clergymen under their control. They were not permitted to operate normally, especially in the central region. Political searches, investigations, and punishments for failure to take the oath, recognizing Anna as the head of the church, of all people, a non-Orthodox person, that just completed the oppression and intimidation and the mockery of the clergy. People had nothing to pay the taxes at this point. The oligarchs raised taxes all over the place. They were selling whatever they could find in their homes, bread, livestock, icons, heirlooms. The best of the nobility were arrested. So much did the Cheka take from this era. The nobility, the mid and lower level nobles, which was the heart and soul of the local politics, were rounded up for their rejection of Anna and Byron and Prokopovich. Many of them died from hunger, overcrowding, typhus. There's too many contemporary sources that talk about these prisons. Russia never knew prisons before. Russia really only developed a prison system in the 19th century. But because of the denunciation system, there was at no time other than the Soviet era were the clergy treated like that. The oligarchy despised the clergy. And in the process, undermined respect for the broader population. This is why the landowners treated them with disdain and oppressed them. But this Masonic Baltic German clique ruled under Byron for 10 years. But the hatred of these Masonic cultists never ended. There was an entire list of new martyrs. I've talked about this many times, over and over again. There was no uprising against them, but they only grumbled. There was under, Catherine II. Protests were ended with the dungeons and the secret chancery. Oligarchy, by definition, is arbitrary. There's no law in an oligarchy. It's simply the interest of the few. Theophan got more and more paranoid as time went on, as did Byron. But the clergy that remained, you've heard me go on about the monks were cut in half. I mean, there was only a handful of monks and monasteries left and this era compared with, you know, prior to Peter. Hundreds and hundreds defrocked and exiled by Theophon himself for not serving royal prayers and requiems for Freemasons and atheists, especially for not taking the oath to the new empress. No Orthodox man could take such a stupid oath, but it was used to decide who was malleable and who wasn't. The old believers, likely the only canonical Orthodox in the country, took over the peasantry. It wasn't so much Alexis and Nikon, but Peter and his successors, where the old believers took over. I'm talking about the priests, old believers with priests, legitimate hierarchy. There you had some canonical regularity, as difficult as it was under these circumstances. And it wasn't just the person who refused to take the oath, clergyman, but their children. They had to be 8 years old or more. Secret chancery interrogated them. They were hit with whips and sent into the army or hard labor. The white clergy fell into decline, and monasteries eventually were emptied. Anyone who, a clergyman or monks who were fit for military service between the ages of 15 and 40 were subject to recruitment. Only those who had a major parish were not. All clergymen, 1737, September 1st, a decree was issued calling out for military service all suitable church clergymen between the ages of 15 and 40. Only priests and deacons were exempt, and of those, only those who had a major parish. So the oath issue coincided with the general purge of the clergy, which occurred over and over again. On the occasion of the Turkish War, the government declared in 1736 a census and a recruitment of the clergy. According to the decree of 1737-1738, non-serving churchmen, which would include monks and children of the clergy, 15 to 40 were taken, fit for military service. Unless they came up with 200 rubles to appoint a hired recruit, and sometimes even then, they were still taken. The theological schools that Prokopovich created, strict examinations were held every 3 years, where, quote, lazy and unsuccessful students were expelled and moved to the army. I don't know how they define lazy and unsuccessful. I have the feeling I know. For disobedience to state authority, one could be tortured and executed starting from the age of 12. If someone was guilty at an earlier age, then their father was taken. From Peter to Elizabeth, the state sought to reduce the number of monasteries and monks. By the decree of 1734, unauthorized tonsure of a monk, only widowed priests and retired soldiers were allowed to be tonsured. A fine of 500 rubles was imposed on the bishop. They were trying to destroy monasticism. There were so many regulations why people couldn't be tonsured. The abbot was exiled for life, and sometimes the property was confiscated. Abbots were to report to the synod the slightest offenses of monks, especially their political unreliability, which means that every word had to be investigated and reported. Once they were defrocked, they were subject to corporal punishment, imprisoned, sent into the army, Siberia, hard labor, or all of them. By the turn of the 19th century, the number of monastics in Russia was about 13,000. Compared with almost 30,000 in 1724. The church had no property rights whatsoever. Even cell property left by the monastic authorities was ordered to be sent to the synod. Yeah, legitimate things like vagrancy and moving from monastery to monastery, yeah, that was banned, but that was just a pretext. The point was they had to remain in the monasteries where the census found them, not where they took their vows. Otherwise, they were sent into the army. All parish priests and monastery authorities were obligated to hunt down those who didn't take the oath. Special detectives were appointed from the spiritual and civil authorities to root this out. Even if there was a legitimate reason to leave the monastery, they had to have a travel permit from the abbot, or the bishop in some cases. Otherwise, they were impressed into the army. The abbot had no power. Everything was now under the synod, which hardly existed, so it came under Prokopovich. Only a handful of times a year could a monk visit his relatives. Nuns weren't allowed to leave the monastery at all. No processions were allowed, anything. You couldn't have paper and ink in monastic cells. Peter and his successors knew the monks hated the revolution. Monks were forbidden to write anything at all. Blasphemy became a death penalty case. Well, again, how do you define this? Lutheran, Masonic, and Catholic propaganda was carried out among the upper classes of Petersburg. And in 1735, all non-Orthodox in the territory of Russia were granted full freedom of religion, but only in the sense that they were able to harm Orthodoxy. I don't have to tell you about the unbelievers. Most of their skeets were destroyed, but that's more than just their, it's not their skeets. These are ancient Muscovite Orthodox institutions. In 1735, an expedition by Colonel Sietin completely destroyed, burned the settlements. About 40,000 unbeliever pilgrims were affected, destroying so many of the older Muscovite Orthodox shrines and institutions. But it wasn't really until Sophia and Peter that the Ulrite became a state crime. By the time we're talking about here, 1740s, 1750s maybe, two-thirds of the peasantry were part of the old ritual. The Cossacks most certainly were. And they were right. Third Rome was explicitly condemned by Peter. I mean, what Nikon and Tsar Alexis did was very minor by comparison to what was happening in this era. The attack on the so-called schism was the attack on Muscovite piety. This is when people started talking about the Antichrist taking over the Third Rome. They weren't just talking about a couple of letters in the spelling of the name Jesus. Don't be stupid. This is what they're talking about. Education. It sounds great to have all these theological schools, but they were secular. Prokopovich controlled them. The clergy had to send their sons to his seminaries and schools using his textbooks. Well, Anna died. She suffered from kidney disease for a long time. The Empress sat down to dine with one of her favorites, whoever it was at the time, and she felt ill. She went unconscious. Strangely, she appointed the young Ivan Antonovich as her successor, and of course Byron as regent. But November 8th, Field Marshal Minich, by agreement with the Emperor's mother, Princess Anna Leopoldovna, arrested Byron. He was sentenced to death, but ultimately he was pardoned and exiled to Siberia. October 17, 1740, Anna died. The German dominance was ended after the coup of November 25, 1741, which brought Elizabeth Petrovna to power. Now, I have a lecture on the great Elizabeth, who was an actual legitimate Orthodox ruler, believe it or not, in this era, the only one. I mean, Peter II, too, but he just wasn't around long enough. So then, what are we talking about here? Byronovshchina. The situation of the Byronic rule. Yes, of course it's complex. We're not talking about just a man. He's just symbolic here. The jesters at Anna's court. Sometimes even Andrei Golitsyn and the descent of the princes of the Volonsky, they played the role of jesters at Anna's court. The Marquis de Chardy said that nobles were noble only in name, but in reality they were slaves and so accustomed to slavery that most of them did not feel that they were noble at all. Mikhail Shcherbatov, who I read a long time ago, who was a kind of a proto-Slavophile, talks about this era. And he talks about a lot of specific individual examples of Byron's arrogance. Prokopovich. A lot of parodies about them. Prokopovich didn't want the autocracy in the same sense that Ivan III or Ivan IV did. He was a Hobbesian. He believed in the strong state for the sake of promoting the revolution. Famous historian Kuliszewski estimated 20,000 exiled to Siberia, even more uprooted and fled wherever they could. And this was the demand of the oligarchy. Complete domination of the upper echelons of the Russian nobility. It wasn't just the church that was purged, it was these men who were purged. Foreigners were only part of the issue. In the 19th century, many of the Baltic Germans were extremely loyal. This was a very different group of people using these clueless women, again, with the exception of Elizabeth, to hide and to rule the country indirectly. Byron never tried to hide his hatred of Russia and Orthodoxy. And almost everyone in Anna's cabinet of ministers agreed. Anatoly Gradovsky, historian, the late 19th century, he said, talking about this era, Anna's cabinet didn't look like the inside of the country. The top of the Russian administration lives the most external political life. Russia is for them only a means to obtain the sums needed to participate in the general chorus of the Western powers. Foreign visitors said this kind of thing all the time. The Marquis de Sardi, addressing both Russians and Germans, he says, the Germans, if one could call this gathering of Danes and Prussians and Westphalians and Livonians and Courlanders, were the first comers. They took advantage of the hands and feet of the people to control its movement. Another foreigner says, Russia has always waged wars since the time of Peter, but it wasn't war that exhausted the state. It was exhausted by luxury, the poor management of ministers, transfer of funds abroad, and finally, licentiousness, vanity. This is what ruins the state. A lot of these guys stole what we would call billions of dollars worth of stuff today. Menshikov, some of his stuff was returned to the treasury. Byron, when he was arrested, he was accused rightly of stealing an untold amount of state money, causing irreparable damage to the state. The court, both from Anna and those around her, expenses went through the roof. 8 million rubles, 1734. Of that 8 million, only 260,000 went to the court, and 100,000 went to the stable. So where did the arrest go? Where did the rest go? It ended up being pocketed, taken from the country. The country then broke and humiliated. I didn't have time to get into the jesters. Peter used them quite a bit. If you go to my lecture on the drunken synod, it was his satanic synod, the drunken madcap sobor, where he mocked Orthodoxy and worshipped Dionysius. And you have to hard proof that he was a demonist. But in the 1730s, it wasn't that there were German and Russian parties. It was an ethnic thing only to the extent that, you know, Russians are going to support Russia, unless they've been deeply corrupted. Because Osterman, Byron, Minnick, they all intrigued against each other. They fought each other over trifles. They manipulated the local nobility. Frankly, they were quite Jewish in their attitudes. And this was before the mass invasion of Jews I shouldn't say invasion, it was the absorption of Jews after the partitions of Poland in the 1790s, finally in the 1790s. You did have an awakening after these Germans were removed, these Masons were removed, and this awakening took place under Elizabeth. But Anna and those who controlled her, you know, this kind of power leads to paranoia. They know they're doing the wrong thing. They know that they're hated. There were many conspiracies in 1740 to overthrow Byron, but only to replace him doing the same thing, just not with him. The Jew Lippmann, of course, was the court banker, and he profited massively from this. The German author E.A. Hermann said that Byron follows only that advice approved by a Jew named Lippmann, who is cunning enough to solve and conduct these intrigues. He alone is initiated into the secrets of the Duke, his master, and is always present at his meetings with anyone. It can be said that this Jew rules Russia. In fact, Desjardins, the Marquis, says that it's not Byron but Lippmann who ruled the Russian Empire at the time. That doesn't improve anything, but it's the same concept. Today you have people saying that the anti-Berovshchina rhetoric, that's just nationalist reaction and manifestations of anti-Semitism. Well, most of the time we're not talking about the Jews here, but their reaction claiming it's anti-Semitic makes me wonder, of course. Of course the Jews were involved. They just weren't there in large enough numbers. It's like Lenin's dictum that anti-communism is anti-Semitism and vice versa. And that's why you have this burst of revisionist history trying to rehabilitate Byron in Russia today and in the West today. After Byron's arrest, the executioner Andrei Ushakov blamed Byron for the cruelty of his own department. There was no law and didn't maintain any. He just did what he was told. There were some that claimed Byron had converted to Judaism. He was a Mason, of course. And his answer was odd, because they said this to him and said, I don't have any place to keep a pastor. Whatever that means, which is a very bizarre defense. Stroyev, the historian, says, talking about Byron, in his Courland home, Byron greatly favored the Jews and generally showed broad religious tolerance as a man touched by the philosophical ideas of the time. Well, tolerance for everything but orthodoxy. Of course, the Jews and Byron had the same agenda, the same enemies. When Byron's daughter converted to orthodoxy, hated her father, she had to flee from home and ask protection from the Empress Elizabeth herself. Her father was going to kill her. Claiming Byron was tolerant really shows the mentality of the people who you're dealing with here. But Lippmann also was financing Anna. The Berovshchina meant, first of all, a centralized system of plundering the country. Now, something the Jews would do later after the partitions of Poland. Byron considered himself and was an equal to the emperors. He determined the fate of Russia for a long time, but focusing on just one man is one thing. He was symbolic of this Masonic cult group that ruled the country. The Spanish ambassador noticed that Count Byron served Her Majesty faithfully for many years while fulfilling the duties of a husband. It was very clear what was going on. The man had no principles. He could adapt very quickly. One time, Byron asked the court jester, "What do Russians think of me?" And the answer he got was, "You, Your Highness, some consider you a god, others Satan, but no one considers you a man." Now, that was the job of the jester at the time, and Byron didn't like it. The field marshal, Count Christopher Minich, arrested Byron and his wife, November 20th, 1740. In the interests of Anna Leopoldovna, he crashed into his bedchambers, went up to the bed in the middle. The Byrons were laying there. They were sleeping so soundly that they didn't even hear him barge in. Finally, the field marshal, grabs him and says, Byron snaps awake and says, "What are you doing? How dare you?" With his typical humility. Well, what did he do? When he saw the soldiers entering the room, he screamed, high-pitched scream in fear, and he crawled under the bed. Well, that's to be expected for such a coward and a phony. They pulled him out, made fun of him, and took him away to the guardhouse. Yeah, Byron was around for a while afterwards, never had this kind of power ever again. Byron did have connections with the Jews, which is one of the reasons he was, pulled out of prison once in a while, or exile once in a while. In Courland, Byron, of course, he was eventually returned there. He refused to allow any Orthodox churches to be built, or even Russian troops to pass through, or to enter any relations, the enemies of Russia. But it wasn't until Catherine II who forced him, said, "Okay, I'll restore you there, but you have to do those things." Otherwise, he wouldn't have. And he died the long life of debauchery and greed. You know, one of his addictions was gambling. What is gambling? It's the attempt to gain profit without work. Perfect for him. Unfortunately, Byron is overshadowed by the fact that the Polish partitions brought millions of hate-filled Jews and Talmudists into the Russian Empire, who after about 100 years created the early versions of the Communist Party and the October Revolution. But this is Byron's legacy. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.